All right, welcome, everybody. Welcome to the March Citizens Climate Lobby call. If you're new to the call, I'll be introducing our guest speaker in just a moment, who it would be hard to find someone that we would be more excited about having on our call today. Then we'll go over a couple of the things that happened since last month's call, and then the most important thing we do every month is get into action. Make sure that we're doing something. The only thing that ever moves anything is action, and that's the most crucial thing that we do every month. I want to tell Representative Curbelo just a little bit about the people he's talking to. So usually live on the call today, there's somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people on the call. There's another 1,000 groups that listen to it in between months, so you're going to be reached several thousand people between now and next month. A couple of things about them is, one, for the last 7 years, these are people who've been saying that Republicans will lead on the issue of dealing with climate change, and to some degree having people tell them that that's crazy, but nevertheless saying this is a nonpartisan issue, people will lead from both parties, so this is very rewarding to have you on the call today. Also, we describe ourselves as a grassroots nonpartisan organization, but there's a gentleman named Bill Shireman who has an organization called Future 500, and he describes the CCL volunteers as transpartisan. He uses an interesting term, transpartisan. I think I saw a sample of that last weekend when I was in Philadelphia when I was there for one of our regional conferences. And just so you know, one of the Gibson signers, Representative Meehan, was our keynote speaker at that conference, Representative Meehan. And at the end of the conference, I was talking about a trip I was making to D.C. after the conference to talk to people from the left and the right about dealing with climate change. And so I was meeting with some of the traditional big green organizations, NRDC, EDF. And some of the organizations on the right included the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, ALEC, the American Legislative Council. And one of the people asked me, what in particular was I going to talk with the Chamber and ALEC about dealing with global warming? And I said, you know, the same thing we always talk about. We go and talk to people, we listen to what we have to say, and we see what we have in common with them. And this joyous cheer erupted in the room. To me, that reflects probably what Mr. Shireman is talking about of a transpartisan organization, people who aren't looking at this from the right or left, but simply about how people working together can solve something. So our guest today, first of all, Representative Curbelo was the first co-signer of the Gibson Resolution. He's the co-chairman of the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. It would be hard-pressed for us to think of someone that we could be more excited about having on the call today. We do have some questions that we hope we can get to today, but first, Representative Curbelo, if you could just tell us a little bit about what the process of starting this Bipartisan Climate Caucus Solution Caucus was and some of the kinds of things that you're hoping to achieve with it. And first of all, welcome and thank you so much for joining our call today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so pleased to join you today. I'm in a beautiful Marathon, Florida. That's in the Florida Keys, which not only is one of the most beautiful parts in the world, but also the tip of the spear when it comes to rising sea levels and this climate change issue that all of you are so involved with. And I want to thank you because as we fight in Congress, as we try to make converts, to convince people, to show them the facts, the data, the evidence, the truth. It really is encouraging and helpful to have an entire community all over the country that for all the right reasons is fighting for this cause. So I thank you. I hope you stay involved, and I hope you continue growing as we continue growing our efforts in the United States Congress. So I realized some time ago that this issue is an existential threat to where I live. And I want to live here for the rest of my life, and my wife and I have two little girls. I want them to have at least a choice to live here in South Florida for the rest of their lives. And if we don't change course, if we don't pay close attention to what's happening and come up with some common sense solutions, we're going to be in very serious trouble. So here in South Florida, regrettably, this is no longer an abstract issue, an issue that we can theorize about. We are already witnessing the effects of climate change and sea level rise. and we know which way the trend is going. So people here are waking up to it. The question for me is, how do we nationalize this effort? How do we bring more people to this cause? And I thought the best approach was somewhere in between what a lot of people consider the two extremes in this whole climate change discussion. The one extreme is the deniers. Every day, their faith, their claims are just more and more reduced and discarded, rightfully so. And then we have what some would call the alarmists, those that want to destroy the economy, put people out of work, you know, from one pit to the next, in the name of the environment. And I understand the concern. I understand the sense of urgency. But I think that the healthy place for all of us is in the middle, where we work to, number one, mitigate human influence on the climate, meaning reducing our carbon footprint, reducing carbon emissions. And number two, take the necessary steps, make the necessary investments to prepare for climate change, especially in areas like South Florida. So Ted Deutsch and I decided to get together. Ted Deutsch is a Democratic colleague of mine from South Florida, also a little further up the road here in the Broward and Palm Beach area. And we said, look, let's put partisanship aside. We understand that sometimes House leadership and Senate leadership on both sides frowns upon members of opposite parties working together. But we said, let's take this risk and let's officially make this climate change issue a bipartisan issue in the House of Representatives by creating this caucus where if you're a Democrat, you can only join if you find a Republican who will join with you, and vice versa. So Ted and I were the founding members, and now our list of membership is thankfully growing. That is not possible without you, without your activism, without your involvement. So I thank you, and I look forward to our dialogue here today and to figuring out how we can continue making progress because we need it.
Okay, good. So, great. So we have several things we'd like to get to. First of all, you know, the last time we got close to dealing, from at least from a congressional standpoint, with climate change was in 2009, and the House passed Waxman-Markey, and the Senate didn't pass anything, and so that was the end of that. And there's a political scientist at Harvard named Theda Scotchpole, who wrote over a 100-page criticism of what the problem was, and really at the heart of that criticism is she said at that point in 2009, all of the support for legislation existed inside the Beltway, and it needed to be back home in district. So let's just start with your district, and I want to ask you, how are we doing in your district? Are we providing enough support, and if not, what are other things that we could be doing to make this easier for you?
You all have been very active. You're absolutely right, and the conclusions after the 2009 effort, I think, are absolutely right. This needs to be driven by the American people. As long as it looks like it's special interests or big corporations or other groups leading this effort, I think we're going to have a tough time building that critical national consensus that'll help give us the critical mass in Congress, meaning the votes, to get this done. So you all are very visible on social media, all over the community, and we just need to do more and more of that. And I think probably the most effective strategy is to convince thought leaders, people who are trusted in local communities. I mean, I think we need to do even more to get into churches, to get more faith-based leaders talking about this issue, and you know the fact that it's not only a practical issue because we all want a healthy planet, and those of us that live in coastal communities would like to remain here, but this is also a moral issue. We have a moral obligation to the planet and to preserving it for future generations. So I would say more penetration into churches, into small businesses, local leaders who people trust and who people will listen to. I think that's how we're going to make the most progress.
Okay, great. The people in the organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, think the appropriate number of people to be on your caucus is 435. But we just, but that would end up with an odd number. So do you have you begin to think out, like, you know, how big you'd like it to be in the short term? And certainly we want to know at some point if you want us to help start reaching out to people. We know that initially you wanted to build it internally, and so we've stayed out of it. We haven't asked people to join. But can you just tell us about, you know, how big do you think it could be? Or do you have a hope or an aspiration for how big you'd like it to be?
Well, my initial goal is to get all of the Republicans who have signed the Gibson resolution to join. I think we're going to be able to do that. That'll mean that we'll need 13 Democrats as well. And I think that will give us a solid base of support, you know, strong presence in the House, 26 members, 13 on each side. And then once all of us have joined, then the goal becomes to recruit new people. And by the way, I have, as you can imagine, had many conversations with Republican colleagues from all over the country, even the Deep South, where you know, some of our ideas are face the most resistance, and people are ready to move on this issue. They're tired of the hyper-politicization of this issue. They're tired of the demagoguery surrounding this issue. They're tired of allowing the disingenuous to hijack the truth with regards to this issue. And they're building the courage to move forward. I think after primary season, you're going to see even more courage, if we can describe that as courage. As a lot of members get past their primaries, I think they're going to be even more open-minded and more willing to do the right thing with regards to this issue. So, yes, I would say that after this first wave of members to join the caucus, we would really like for CCL to get engaged, start reaching out to members of Congress from all over the country and telling them, hey, find someone from the opposite party and join this caucus, because this is going to become the driver of policy on with regard to climate change in the House.
Well, and I'm glad you used the word courage, because I received a lot of notes from our volunteers around the country, and actually a lot from Canada also, using you and the word courage together. And it's interesting that the question that was asked most often was, do you believe that this bipartisan caucus has the chance of having broader implications in Congress? So, you know, we know the formation of this isn't the Berlin Wall coming down, but is it a little crack? Does it foretell the possibility of having the Congress work together in a more productive way?
Yes, this is officially the beginning. I mean, before this caucus, the topic of climate change was not a bipartisan topic or issue. By coming together and saying, look, forget the letters that come after our names. We want to do the right thing. This is a real issue. We want to find some practical solutions, hopefully some market-based solutions. From my perspective, a true healthy alternative to the EPA and to some of the regulations that many people find arbitrary and just unpredictable, really. This is it. This is our hope. This is the beginning, and I have no doubt that we will be successful. The question is, how long will it take? Your efforts and my efforts will determine that. The harder we work, the sooner we will have a solution, an answer, to the challenge of climate change in our country.
Great. And the other question that was often asked was, you know, this is really one of the most polarizing issues for a lot of people around the country. And so a lot of people asked, you know, how do we, what advice do you have as we try and move the issue towards something where everybody sees common ground, where they see that they can work together? What guidance would you give us about how we would reach out to people to, you know, have them see more what we have in common than this rather than what separates us or divides us?
I'll share with you a tactic or a line that I use with my Republican colleagues in the House. I tell them, and I've said it to some in the media as well, that ignoring climate change is as reckless or as irresponsible as ignoring our country's growing national debt and the fiscal crisis that looms if we do not take action and make some meaningful reforms to some of our mandatory spending programs. This is the same theme as when it comes to climate change. The debt with the climate is growing. The debt with the earth, with nature, with the environment is growing. And if we don't address it, if we ignore it, the way some of my friends on the left would like to do with the fiscal situation in this country, if we ignore it, we're going to be doomed. And the longer we ignore it, the longer we take to act, the more painful the remedy is going to be. So, you know, try to phrase things in a way that appeals to the people you're trying to convince. It's not helpful to dismiss people as being ignorant, as not caring. Or, you know, hey, maybe it's true, but that's not going to move the ball forward for us. That's not going to get us any closer to where we want to be. So, yeah, that's why, again, I think going back to these trust leaders, opinion leaders in communities is so important, because you need someone to stand up on a stage in every community and say, hey, forget, you know, partisanship, forget how you feel about, I don't know, taxes or any other issue. This is a challenge that we all face and that we all need to solve together.
Great. Let me ask you, so it makes complete sense to me that we would do more outreach after people get through their primaries, and, you know, it probably in some cases wouldn't help to try and reach out in advance of primaries because it could hurt people politically. We saw from the building of the Gibson resolution that that was a one-by-one phenomena. Are there things that we can learn from how the Gibson co-sponsors were built that then would apply to adding people onto the bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus?
Yeah, just remember that the first ones are always the toughest to get. And after that, once people feel that there's a soft landing place and that there are others there to stick with, it gets a lot easier. So don't get discouraged at first. I'll tell you, I was right there with Chris fighting every day to get colleagues to sign our resolution. We're still doing that, by the way. We're still trying to get more. And some days it was discouraging. A lot of people didn't even want to talk about this. Oh, why are you focused on that? You know, you'd have to come back to people over and over again. But once you get the first few, you will naturally see a greater flow of people following. That's just the nature of pioneering, right? So, I would just encourage you to not give up on anyone. You would be surprised. There are members of Congress from South Carolina, from states that are you wouldn't think are interested in this issue, and they are, and they're very close to doing the right thing.
Great. Let me ask you something for some guidance on something that's not specifically on this issue, but more just in terms of meeting with our members of Congress. You know, in June we have our annual conference, and we expect to see about 500 members of the House and Senate, and while people are home in district, we're doing a big lobby drive, and we expect to probably make a couple of hundred visits. Are there things that make meetings with constituents work or not work? So are there things that if people do that, it makes the meetings go well? And are there things that we should, you know, make sure that we don't do, because when that happens, the meeting is inherently bad?
Well, what I tell you is it's wonderful that you're going to Washington. Members certainly need to see people there walking the halls of Congress. But it may even be more important to see members in their district offices, or maybe not even in an office. Don't meet with them in an office. Try to meet with them at someone's house or maybe at a restaurant, something that shows that you're just another interest group asking for some benefit or lobbying for some bill, that you are just ordinary citizens, leaders in your community for sure, but just people who care about this issue and who want your representative in Congress to represent those, what you believe in and really what we need to be successful on this issue in the future. So I would try to make your meetings as informal, as pleasant as possible. And look, we all know, everyone on this call is familiar with the data. We know that this is a serious issue, that this requires immediate attention. But be careful not to make it seem like you're trying to scare people, because people then feel like you might be trying to manipulate them. So just try to stay sober. I'd say sobriety goes a long way when you talk to members of Congress, and humor does too. I tell some of my colleagues who blow me off, I say, that's all right. When my district's underwater, I'm going to move to your state and I'm going to run against you. And you know, it gets a laugh, and it kind of, you know, loosens the soil. So.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. And that's the other question, the last one that we were asked quite a bit, and you've addressed it quite a bit, but I'll just give you one last shot at it, and that is, you know, we've been saying for 7 years this is a nonpartisan issue, and we'll get leadership from both sides of the aisle, but any other guidance in particular at helping more Republicans to lead on this issue?
I just frame it in a way that is appealing to Republicans. I think that, you know, the fiscal comparison, it's worked for me. And then talk to them about market-based solutions. I mean, I guess it varies with every person, but I'm sure some of your members are not big EPA fans and understand that it's probably not the most efficient way of getting to our objective on this issue. So say, hey, we want an alternative to the EPA. We don't want the EPA, you know, to arbitrarily decide who gets regulated and how much and who pays. You know, we want a market-based approach that's predictable, that families and businesses can plan and say, okay, you know, there's a cost to pollution. This is how we're going to avoid it. This is how we're going to be more efficient. Use the themes and the ideas that are really going to appeal to small government, limited government conservatives that prefer and believe, as I do, that markets usually lead us to ideal places, as opposed to, you know, bureaucracy and heavy-handed government regulation.
Yeah, well, that's really particularly reassuring to hear from you, because we believe we've been making a case for a libertarian proposal for quite some time, that essentially there's a market failure because the externalities are not included in the direct price, so you simply correct that market failure and let the market go to work. So that's really
interesting. And by the way, we have a carbon tax now. It's you know, we don't line item it, but we do have a carbon tax. Everything the EPA does is a carbon tax. It's just in many ways arbitrary. It's unpredictable. It's it's now subject to court challenges. It's just unhealthy. So, I mean, a lot of people I think don't understand that. Oh, well, I'm against carbon tax. Well, do you know that there's a carbon tax now, and that it's somebody paid for it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, Representative Cabrillo, so Representative Jolly, who's also on the Gibson Resolution, spoke at our conference in Florida a couple of weeks ago and got multiple standing ovations. And same thing with Representative Meehan, spoke at our conference in Philadelphia last weekend and got multiple standing ovations. So we are going to attempt a virtual standing ovation.
You don't have to do that. Thank you.
No. We want to do this. What we're going to do is we're going to unmute the lines and we're going to ask everybody to just yell out thank you. Now, there's a good chance this is going to be extremely chaotic, but I can't tell you how much excitement and gratitude there is from our organization about what you're doing and being on this call. So if you could just bear with me for 1 second, I'm going to unmute the line. I'm going to give people about 15 seconds to say thank you, and then I'll remute the lines.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
All right, Representative Cabrillo, that's our version of...
Hey, that sounded like a whole stadium full of people. Thank you. I'm proud to fight with you. Count on me. Let's keep working towards our goal.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Really appreciate you being on the call today, and thanks for all you're doing. Okay, so... that made me happy. I hope it made everybody else out there happy also. So we have a few things we want to do. In terms of the updates, since last month's call, we are going to focus on international updates. So I'm going to ask Kathy from Sudbury to come on because there are so many exciting things that are happening in Canada right now. I want to talk a little bit more on some international stuff and then talk about some of the preparation we're going to be doing for the call. So first of all, Kathy, could you say your name so I can hear you?
Bonjour, Marc. Comment ça va?
Bonjour, ça va?
I thought since our Prime Minister was in Washington, you might have brushed up on your French this week.
I brushed off on it, and I hope this time you'll tell me my French is good rather than usually très mal. But anyway, tell us a little bit about what's happening in Canada, because it is pretty exciting.
It has been ground-changing, mind-boggling awesome up here. I'd like to just pull back a little bit and remind everybody that in Paris, at the United Nations Climate Talks in November, Canada joined the Carbon Pricing Coalition, and our Minister of Environment and Climate Change was very much involved in the final details of the Paris negotiations. And we've just been moving forward since then. Prime Minister Trudeau announced in mid-February that there are plans for a nationally integrated carbon pricing policy for Canada. And those are just plans because provinces have a lot of say in energy policies, and a lot of the provinces have already gone ahead. And he made this announcement approximately 2 weeks prior to the Vancouver Declaration or the Globe 2016 Summit. And part of that summit included the premiers, which are leaders of our provinces in Canada, and the prime minister got together and discussed climate change, something that had not really happened for a decade up here. And they came away from that meeting with the Vancouver Declaration, which includes forming four working groups, one of them being carbon pricing policy, and they will be working towards a nationally integrated carbon pricing plan. Lots of details have to be worked out yet, but very exciting. And just as we were catching our breath from that, last weekend, the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario, Patrick Brown, and Ontario being our largest province, declared at a convention, climate change is a fact, it is a threat, it is man-made. We have to do something about it, and that something includes putting a price on carbon. And if you read deeper, it looks like he's looking seriously at a revenue-neutral carbon price. And then if you thought it could get even better, at the same moment, Sun Media's chief editor, Lori Goldstein, came out hard for a revenue-neutral carbon tax in his editorial this week. It's been a phenomenal week, and politicians – can't act until we, the people, tell them what to do. So there's so much gratitude I have right now, and I'm so hesitant to pinpoint just one, but I'm just going to say it generally, that a tremendous amount of work has been done by our volunteers and a lot of climate organizations here in Ontario and Canada. I'd also like to especially thank the TV and radio and print media who keep holding our leaders accountable. And very exciting, you know, up here in Canada, we're no longer debating climate change. We're debating what's the best carbon pricing policy and what to do with the revenue. This has just been a tremendous week, probably the most exciting week in 5.5 years.
And great, Kathy.
Lastly,
before I pivot to the rest of the world in the U.S., what are we doing for actions this month in Canada?
Okay, so in Canada, quickly, our volunteers are asked to send citizen climate lobby postcards or handwritten letters to your MPs and premiers showing that you support a nationally integrated price on carbon with carbon fee and dividend as the overarching national policy. You can lobby your MP this spring in your home riding, or you can come to Ottawa. But really, your home riding is just fine. Yeah, in Ontario, be sure to comment on the cap and trade proposal online by March 25th on the Ontario's website, and British Columbia, send those awesome cartoons that CCL Nelson and other members put together. So thanks so much,
great.
Mark, and thank you, everyone.
Yep, outstanding. So exciting what's happening in Canada. I mean, a discussion of a national consistent price, remarkable. Just really, really great. Okay, in just a moment, I want to bring Madeline and Ellie to talk about some of our preparation for our meetings, the in-district meetings and the conference. There's two other things I want to mention before we do that, though. So one of the consequences of the talks in Paris is the number of supporters who've come from other countries has exploded since Paris. So here's the countries that have registered on our site as people from those countries supporting CCL. In Africa, that includes Burundi, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Gambia, Kenya, Malawi, Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania, and Togo. In Asia, Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates. In Europe, Denmark, France, Germany, Iceland, Italy, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Romania, Spain, Sweden, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom, Latin America, Argentina, Mexico, Panama, Peru, Puerto Rico, and in the Pacific, Australia, and New Zealand. So that has been pretty remarkable that the majority of that has happened since Paris. I also want to mention that in the month of January and February, CCLers did 155 presentations, and last month we announced that anybody that did 8 presentations would get a CCL shirt and pointer at the conference, and Eve Simmons already hit that, so if other people have, we'll announce them as they come along. So a lot of people are doing presentations, and that is phenomenal. So last month we talked about that we identified 6 areas that were the most common issues that were brought up. So, for instance, you'll see there's a laser talk on the EPA in the action sheet this month. So there were 6 items that were brought up, and so we are going to present those 2 laser talks each month. I mean, 2 of those laser talks each month between now and the conference. So 2 today, 2 in May, 2 in June, so that the 6 that were brought up most consistently are the ones we're going to focus on and we're going to ask you to practice. But we have another exercise that we also think would be really, really useful. So if you've been to the regional conferences, you've seen that one of the things we've been working very intently on is to try and enhance our capacity to listen to people, to ask questions, to draw people out, rather than simply responding with our answer to whatever concern they have. We think that the right time when people are ready to be communicated with is when they've told us they are ready. So first of all, Madeline and Ellie, if you could say your name so that I know you're on the line.
Here's Ellie.
Okay, Ellie,
and
great.
Madeline.
Okay, perfect, thank you. Okay, so what we wanted to do is we released the paper from Kevin Ummel a few weeks ago, and one of the things that it showed was that the people who benefited most from our policy in terms of economically are people that are in the lowest quintile. So the people who are least well off are the people who do best under our proposal. And that brought up some concern for some people that people would think of our policy as income redistribution. So we debated a couple of possible solutions And we're going to have the ones that won out, which was Ellie and Madeline's. Mine was, why do you call everything income redistribution, you blockhead? For some reason, that one didn't win, but Ellie and Madeline's did. So what they're going to simulate is a discussion between a staffer and one of us about the issue of income redistribution coming up in our new model of trying to do more of asking questions to get to the bottom, not necessarily responding immediately with our answers. Okay, who's the staffer and who's the volunteer?
I'm the staffer, Ellie.
Okay.
All right,
and
so I'll start off.
Madeline's the volunteer.
Okay, Ellie, go ahead.
All right, Madeline, this looks like a form of income redistribution to me.
Oh, can you say more about why this looks like income redistribution to you?
Well, obviously, wealthier people are paying more of the carbon fee than poor people, so they come out behind.
I'm wondering if this is an issue of fairness to you.
Yeah, I think everyone should be treated the same.
It matters to me, too, that things be fair. That's why I like it that everyone gets the same dividend instead of some people getting more and some less. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah, but there are still some winners and some losers here.
Yeah, you're right, there are. Why do you think that is?
Well, I suppose it's because some people use more fossil fuel than others, so their costs go up more than the people who use less fossil fuel.
I think you're right. You know, to me that seems fair because people have other choices, and they can even use the dividend to help them do that. So I think the purpose is not to redistribute income, but rather the carbon fee is helping people become more responsible. What do you think?
Well, my boss is very into the idea of personal responsibility, and I'm beginning to see what you mean. I'll think about this some more.
Okay, great.
Great.
Ian.
Okay, thank you both so much. Ellie, really well done. Madeline, if you could stay on for just another minute here. So what we're wanting to do, and we'd like you to do that exercise in your groups today, is we want to reinforce something that we've been developing and working very hard on the regional conferences that we worked on the national conference last year, in that, you know, people are probably best able to hear what you want to say when they tell you. And lots of times we start talking before they give us any indication that they're interested in hearing what we have to say, and so we're trying to work on our capacity of asking questions and generating some interest from them so that they're asking us what we want to tell them. Okay, so in just a second, Madeline's going to go over the U.S. actions this month. And before she does that, you know, there's a lot of stuff you can do here. There's a lot of stuff. There's the actions every month. There was a fantastic CCLU on how to have effective meetings inside the community. And sometimes it can seem like, at least to me, that there's an overwhelming amount of stuff to do. So how should you choose what you're going to do each month? I think what you ought to choose to do is whatever lights you up, because I think the things that light you up are the things that you're going to do best. So when you hear us say, here's the recommended actions this month, you should do the ones that actually light you up, not the ones you have to do. I wouldn't recommend doing the ones you feel like you have to do, but the ones where you go, that would light me up, I'm going to go do that, and I think if it would light you up, you'll do it in the best possible way you can. So, Madeline, what are we doing in the U.S. this month?
Okay, and I'm so glad you said that, Mark. That's really helpful. Our actions this month are, one, prepare for listening sessions, town hall meetings, or campaign events, and include thinking strategically about the best questions to ask for your particular political situation. And the second one is set a goal for how many people from your group that you'd like to have going to the international conference in D.C. As part of reaching that goal, you might pass around a sheet for people to indicate if they're coming, if they're thinking about it, or they can't come. And you might discuss ways to coordinate transportation or housing. That's it, Mark.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think that maybe the way you think about the national conference is how many people do you want to have there to make sure that your meetings with your member of the House and your senators goes well? You know, as we get closer to the conference, we'll keep sharing with you some of the things that we're excited about. So, for instance, I don't know how many of you know that Michael Mann, who's probably the second most famous climate scientist in our country after Jim Hansen, is going to be at the conference. You've probably heard of his iconic hockey stick talk. So Michael Mann is actually going to talk about his famous hockey stick talk, and we're excited about that. I'm also really excited about the experts that we have lined up to talk about climate and weather. I think that's an area where we always wonder, where is the line? What can you attribute to climate change and extreme weather, and what is just natural variability? So that's another thing that I am really, really excited about. Okay, so then the last thing for today's call is we had a poem sent in from Roger in New Jersey, and one of Roger's things, which we should all get read correct, is the correct spelling of George Shultz's name. So here's the poem, four lines, that Roger wrote to help us all spell George Shultz correctly. He says, George Shultz is our hero, you agree. Please spell his name with no C. But also don't forget to add that T. That's our request, respectfully. Great poem, Roger. Thank you so much again. George Shultz is our hero, you agree. Please spell his name with no C. That's the mistake we make most often. But please don't forget to add that T. That's our request, respectfully. So in terms of Roger Strike, we'll probably add him to Byron, Shelley, Keats, Yeats, and now Roger as one of the great romantic poets. Thank you all for everything you're doing. Great work. I can't wait to hear about the in-district lobby meetings. I know some of them have already happened. We can't wait to see the reports on those. In the April call, we'll be able to do an accounting of everything that happened for that. And we're also beginning all the preparation as we start to move towards June and try to see the whole Congress again. Thanks, everybody. Bye.